You show me a woman with a naturally beautiful body, and I'll show you a tramp, said Joan Rivers. Determined to make it in show business, Joan did become the first lady of comedy, where nothing was sacred. Can we talk? Oh, give me a break. Grow up! Next on Through the Eyes of Women. Welcome to Through the Eyes of Women, a program featuring the lives and perspectives of women, local, national, and international. Leslie Bennett, you have written a fantastic book on the late Joan Rivers.
Thank you.
Before we get into the book, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm a longtime journalist. I started out as a newspaper reporter. I was a writer for Vanity Fair for 24 years, and I'm an author. And in all of those capacities, I've been interviewing thousands of women for decades as a journalist. But I have never come across a subject that is as compelling as Joan Rivers was in terms of being entertaining and inspiring and contradictory and infuriating and very, very complicated. So she was really quite a trip to write about.
Why did you pick Joan?
Well, her life story is extremely interesting but also different. For hundreds of years, you could argue for thousands of years, most of the stories that are about women involve finding a man, whether it's, Greek mythology or Jane Austen or today's chick lit and chick flicks. And Joan Rivers grew up thinking that the key to a woman's happiness was finding Mr. Right, which was how you were raised in the 1950s when she came of age. And, one of her proudest accomplishments was finding a husband. But the truth was that her husband ruined her life. And although she was very successful in the first half of her life, she found herself in her 50s with her career destroyed and her fortune vanished. Her husband left her $37 million in debt when he killed himself. She was 54. And the thing that's so unusual and inspiring about Joan Rivers' life is that in the second half of life, mostly in her 60s and 70s, which is an age when women are fighting terrible ageism and sexism in any field, but certainly in the entertainment industry, she not only staged, the comeback of all time and put herself back on top in the entertainment industry, but she also became a CEO. She built a billion-dollar business. She essentially invented the modern red carpet industry, which is another multi-billion-dollar industry. And she had this phenomenal second act when she finally took responsibility for her own life. And today, with women living longer and longer, the topic of reinventing your life and your career is very much in the zeitgeist, and it's necessary because women have such long lifespans now, which we didn't in my grandmother's time. So Joan Rivers is really one of the most inspiring role models I've ever come across for a lot of challenges that are of huge importance now. They were always challenging, but the relevance is just unbelievable these days.
Well, you write in the book that growing up in a family where dad didn't make enough money for mom.
a lot of stress there.
A lot of stress. And Joan vowed then to never depend on a husband to support her.
Yeah, she was very embittered by her childhood. Her father was a doctor. She didn't really grow up poor, but her mother had these kind of delusions of grandeur. She had grown up in a wealthy family in Russia, and she wanted to live in a much higher level than her husband, Joan's father, was able to afford. So she was always overspending, and Joan's father was always, having fits because he couldn't pay the bills. And there was a tremendous amount of anger and recriminations in the family household because of terrible financial insecurity. And Joan, at a very early age, decided that, as she put it, money is power, and I'm never going to be without it. I'm never going to depend on a man, and I'm always going to be able to take care of myself, because she did not want to turn into her mother. Her mother was completely miserable, and although marriage was very important to Joan, she always earned her own money.
You know, you mentioned the Russian immigrants. I guess that's why maybe the condo in New York City was, somebody referred to it as Anastasia's grandmother's apartment.
Yes, the people usually referred to it as Versailles, because when she moved back to New York and, you know, after her life fell apart in California, she had this dream vision of the place she wanted to live, and it was very sort of, you know, gold, you know, gilding all over, and, you know, Louis the this and the that, antiques. She always said that it was the way Marie Antoinette would have lived if she'd had the money. But if people didn't compare it to the French court, they compared it to the Russian czars and, you know, to that heritage, because it was very, very grand.
And I bet she wished her mother could see it all.
She very much did, and she even said that many times. I think, you know, the sad things about becoming very successful in your later years is you wish your parents could see how well you've done, you know, because her mother was always so frustrated. Her mother lived to see Joan be reasonably successful earlier on, but not her triumphant later years.
Well, as you talk about the book, she graduated from Barnard. She was a very, very smart woman. She didn't follow in the footsteps of her sister, who became a lawyer, who was prettier and maybe smarter. She probably thought she was.
Joan thought she was prettier and smarter and more popular and blonder, which was all the things that mattered to Joan.
You know, you have pictures in the book, and my favorite one is probably, you said that it was Joan's favorite, from a little girl.
She was 3 years old.
Yes.
And she said she loved this picture because it was the last time she was a natural blonde. You know, she had these adorable blonde ringlets, as many toddlers do. But after that, it sort of turned this mousy brown color. And so from then on, it was, you know, she needed artificial enhancement.
She also said that comedy only comes from a place of tragedy or anger or being hurt. The worst thing that can happen to a comedian is to fall in love and to be happy. You're screwed. Get out of the business. And you write about how her career is really the romance in her life.
Well, you know, it's funny because this culture tells women that men are the answer. You know, if you look back on thousands of years worth of literature, men go and conquer the wilderness and you know, fly into space and sail out across the oceans and invent things and have these exciting journeys. But the stories for women are really all about finding a man. And, you know, that is what she was raised with. But the truth is that although she idealized love and marriage and having an appropriate husband the way most women do, it never made her happy. And what really made her happy was performing. She loved that more than anything. She said that it was more necessary to her survival than oxygen or food. And to her, I think it was the purest form of love. She discovered performing in a preschool when she was cast as a kitten, and she had these cute little pink, you know, kitten ears, and she got up on stage, and she made people laugh, and to her, this was like discovering the greatest drug in the world. You know, it was like you could get up there and make people love you, and she became completely addicted to that feeling. She was addicted to it all of her life. I mean, and for her, I think it was sort of like being a crack addict, you know, in a very happy way. It was just the most intense form of happiness and joy and finding love that was available in human existence as far as she was concerned. And in the end, it made her a lot happier. She, you know, she had two husbands and actually quite a lot of lovers, even though she spent her whole life making fun of herself for not being desirable to men, but actually she had a rather active romantic life. But it was her career that really, really made her happy.
Well, she said laughter gave her power, and the insecurity that she ran with as a child, not being pretty enough, not being able to fit in. She was always an outsider and never fit in with the right people, never had the knack, you said.
Yeah, she could never understand why, you know, if she could get up on a stage and make people laugh, why wasn't she able to be popular in school or with boys? And she told a lot of really painful stories about, you know, childhood and adolescent rejections. And those really wounded her for life. And she always perceived herself as an outsider. Certainly trying to get into comedy in those days, it was totally a boys' club. It was very resistant to women. And she became the first late-night television talk show host who was a woman, and she's still the only one who, you know, was a network television talk show host, although there have been a couple on cable since then. And so she was always going into these inhospitable environments and being rejected and trying to win people over. She said that being a comedian demanded the skills and the command of a lion tamer. She really saw it as a very, you know, powerful role. Comedic actresses have a script, you know, they have a part to play in a, you know, on television or in a movie or whatever. But a stand-up comic gets up there on a bare stage with a microphone and they've got nothing except what comes out of their head and out of their mouth. And it's really, it's teetering on the edge all the time. So it's a high-risk venture, and the payoff is apparently extremely intense. All the women comedians I interviewed said there's absolutely nothing like it when you succeed. It's an incredible high.
And the book is filled with a lot of stories. And as you just said, you interviewed a lot of comedians.
Joan Rivers influenced all of them, you know, Margaret Cho and Sarah Silverman and, you know, Kathy Griffin and Amy Schumer. None of these people really would have careers if it hadn't been for Joan Rivers. And the interesting thing is that today all the hottest names in comedy are women. There are all these younger women who are Joan's, you know, natural heirs. But in her day, she was the groundbreaker. She was really the pioneering one who, you know, who had to break through all the barriers, because they really, as I said, they weren't letting women into the boys' club back then.
No, so she kind of went from Barnard College to Greenwich Village, but she also had a stint in Chicago that I didn't know about. Your book is filled with lots of factoids that people just don't know.
Well, you know, she wanted to be an actress. Comedy was kind of like a fallback position for her. She saw herself as some great dramatic actress, and she spent 10 years trying to succeed and making the rounds and auditioning and getting nowhere. And the things that she did do, you know, were terrible. And she finally got her first real job when she auditioned for Second City, which was an improvisational comedy troupe in Chicago that has a lot of very distinguished alumni. And she was accepted, and that was very important training for her. So she worked there for a while, and then she thought, okay, now I'm ready to come back to New York and you know, return as the conquering hero. And, of course, she came back, and New York couldn't have cared less. And one of the amazing things about Joan Rivers' early career is that she spent 10 years being rejected and booed off the stage and, you know, not being able to get gigs and having the most incredible humiliation and discouragement. At one point, she was homeless and living in her car after she had a fight with her parents and ran off. And she was just totally broke. And after 10 years of, you know, the kind of discouragement that very few people would have been able to withstand, she finally got a shot on Johnny Carson's Tonight Show. And that one appearance made her into what, of course, everybody called an overnight success. She woke up the next morning and she was a star.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Through the Eyes of Women here on KHSU. I'm your host, Brenda Starr. And my guest is author Leslie Bennetts, whose latest release is Last Girl Before Freeway, The Life, Loves, Losses, and Liberation of Joan Rivers. So you mentioned the Johnny Carson show, and I believe it was probably Johnny Carson who introduced her to Edgar, her husband?
Yes, Johnny was actually responsible for introducing Joan to her husband. Her parents thought she was a terrible spinster because she was in her early 30s and they hadn't gotten her married off yet. And in fact, the title of the book, Last Girl Before Freeway, is an iconic Joan Rivers joke, because she used to say that her parents were so desperate about marrying off their spinster daughter that her mother had put up a sign in the front yard saying, "Last girl before freeway," in hopes that some passing man would take her off their hands. And, you know, she was in her 30s when she met and married Edgar, and this Edgar Rosenberg was his name. He was a producer, and they had this whirlwind courtship, and they met because Edgar wanted a writer to work on a project that he was trying to develop, and the Carson Show recommended Joan, who was a comedy writer. That's how she was billed in her first appearance, as a girl comedy writer, because girls didn't really do stand-up then. So Joan and Edgar met, and they were married within days. It was a disastrous marriage, but it lasted for 22 years before Edgar killed himself and left her in the lurch.
So Edgar has a partner. He used to say, "We run a factory, and Joan is the product."
Right.
Who really ran that factory? Was it Joan?
Well, that's
or was
a
it
really
Edgar?
Good question. I mean, you know, the construct was Joan was the star, and he was, you know, the man behind the star. Joan, of course, you know, grew up a girl, and she thought she wasn't good at math and didn't like reading the contracts, so she started relying on her husband to be her business manager, first of all. And Edgar also wanted to be an important producer in Hollywood, but he didn't manage to build a career on his own. So at a certain point, he figured he could hitch his wagon to Joan's star. And that really sowed the seeds of her destruction, because she was very successful as Johnny Carson's favorite substitute host on The Tonight Show. That was a permanent gig, and it gave her huge visibility, and then she went off to Vegas and made tons of money as a headliner. And everything was going really well, but Edgar wanted to be a producer. So when the Fox network started up in the mid-1980s, they needed a marquee name for a talk show, and Edgar figured that if Joan left NBC and The Tonight Show and had her own show on the new Fox network, he, Edgar, could be the producer. So he had an ulterior motive for urging Joan to betray Johnny Carson, which had terrible consequences for her, and go over to Fox. And what happened was she did that. She was blackballed in the industry because everybody thought she had treated her mentor, Johnny Carson, so badly. And then the show on Fox flopped because Edgar was a terrible producer. And they were both fired, and Edgar was so ashamed and depressed that he killed himself. And when he killed himself, she found that he had squandered all of her money on bad investments, and she was $37 million in debt. So as she approached her 55th birthday, it really seemed as though her life was in ruins.
You know, you talk in the book about the story behind her leaving. There was a list, a so-called list that said that the men who would be considered as Johnny Carson's replacement, and subsequently he didn't leave for probably another 10 years. It seems like that might have been a bad joke.
Well, there's an essential mystery at the heart of this story, and most of the principals are dead, but I did my best to solve it. The story was always that the reason Joan left Carson was that she was leaked a secret inside memo that had been prepared by the NBC brass about who was going to succeed Johnny Carson as host of The Tonight Show when he retired. Now, at that point, he was not ready to retire, and he didn't retire for many years after that. But supposedly, she got this memo, and even though she was the top substitute for Carson, she got the highest ratings, and in fact, she was pulling higher ratings than Johnny a lot of the time. All 10 names on this secret list were men, and none of them were as successful as she was. And she flipped out because she thought, oh my God, NBC is going to betray me, and I'm not going to be Carson's successor, so I'd better leave and make my own way. And people always said, this didn't make sense. Why would NBC have done this? Why would they have had this secret list? And what I discovered doing my reporting, Joan's former manager is firmly convinced that this memo was a prank. Joan used to play these pranks, these, you know, jokes on all of her friends, and they used to do them back to her. And she had a friend at NBC who was the one who leaked the memo and signed it when he sent it to her. He died of a cocaine overdose a couple of years later, and so he, you know, can't be consulted at this point. But there's a lot of evidence that this might have been just a vicious joke that really went wrong, because it changed the course of her life. It changed the course of, you know, all of NBC's executive calculations, and it had terrible consequences.
Kind of diabolically ironic. Joan was noted also for her, let's say, alternative facts and stories. Yeah.
She kind of pioneered in that area as well. I wasn't completely aware of this when I started. And, you know, when you research her, you find all these things that are supposedly part of her biography, like she graduated Phi Beta Kappa from Barnard. But, you know, it finally dawned on me that I just had to double-check some of these things, and I would find out, no, she didn't earn Phi Beta Kappa. She didn't even earn any honors. So, you know, there was this whole succession of things that she was certainly not averse to embroidering on the facts for the purposes of, you know, burnishing her image. She was very much about, you know, the public image, and so she would say anything. And in fact, in her later years, when she was 80 years old, she created this big sex scandal by claiming that she had slept with Johnny Carson to get on the show. She also claimed to have slept with the movie star Robert Mitchum, who was a huge star when Joan was younger. And one of her friends said to her, "Oh my God, Joan, I had no idea you had sex with all those people. The next thing you'll do is tell me you had sex with President Kennedy." And Joan said, "I did. I just never told you about it." So the bottom line is, you know, only Joan and JFK know for sure, because she would say anything to get attention.
She also wrote a lot of books.
A lot of books, really, and extraordinary. I mean, you know, 12 or 15 bestsellers of all kinds, self-help, fiction, nonfiction, you know, memoirs, joke books. She was an unbelievably prolific person. She was a workaholic, and no matter how much she had or had done, it was never enough. So she was incredibly driven always about, you know, extending her career in every direction possible.
Well, she went from self-deprecation to fictional characters. I think of Heidi Abramowitz to begin with, then real people. And interestingly enough, that got her in a little trouble.
Self-deprecation she started out with. She was making fun of herself for being this, you know, flat-chested wallflower, which she actually wasn't. And Heidi Abramowitz, who's this fictional character she invented, she hated women who were beautiful because she was so mad that she wasn't beautiful. And so she invented this fictional schoolmate, Heidi Abramowitz, because as far as she was concerned, if you were beautiful, you were promiscuous. So she kind of invented slut shaming before it even had a name. And she was always making jokes about how trampy beautiful women were. But at a certain point, she realized, with the growth of celebrity culture in the 70s and 80s, she realized she could start making fun of other famous women, particularly the beautiful ones. And her favorite target was Elizabeth Taylor. She had been mad at Elizabeth Taylor ever since they were children. They were about the same age. But Elizabeth Taylor was a huge child star, and she was a big international movie star by the time she was a teenager. So, of course, Joan Rivers hated her. And when Elizabeth Taylor started gaining weight in middle age, again, Joan Rivers was fat-shaming Elizabeth Taylor before the term fat-shaming was even invented. And that really rocketed her into the stratosphere in terms of comedy. Audiences really ate it up. I mean, they liked the theater of cruelty, but she was vicious to Taylor and then, you know, throughout the rest of her life to a succession of other women.
Well, I guess, you know, coming back from the ashes that she did and saying that she will rise again, there is a fierceness that you get. She was kind of born with that fierceness, too, but she never accepted the label of feminist. Why not?
Well, her friends used to tease her about it. Kathy Griffin said to me that, she said, I used to tell her, Joan, you're the biggest hypocrite in the world. You are a feminist in every possible way. After all, the word feminist, the definition of it means somebody who believes in the social and political and legal equality of women. So if you're not a feminist, you believe that women are second-class citizens. And obviously Joan did not believe women were second-class citizens. She was just afraid, you know, when back when feminism was not so fashionable as it is right now, she was just afraid it was going to hurt her ticket sales. She used to say to Kathy Griffin, I can just see those ticket sales flying out the window. Don't call me a feminist. But her friends thought that this was ridiculous and that she was a feminist in every possible way because, as you said, she could not have been more fierce about asserting women's right to do anything, you know, that they wanted to do.
And although she always wanted to be a high society girl, you say that the last 10 years of her life, she was completely bored by it.
It was another goal that she managed to achieve, and then she kind of got bored with it. She had lived out in California when she got married and was raising her daughter, Melissa. And then when her husband killed himself, she moved back to New York and then built this, you know, Palace of Versailles and reinvented herself. And she wanted to be one of these New York socialites. And one of her best friends was Blaine Trump, who was Donald Trump's sister-in-law. And all of these beautiful, fashionable, you know, very chic, elegant women. And Joan wanted to make herself into one of them. So she joined that social set and spent years doing all the things that the ladies who lunch do. But eventually, I think she did get bored with it. She had achieved it. But what she really cared about was work. At 80, she was flying all over the country, you know, taking the red eye and pulling her little rolly bag and going to stay in some tacky motel in the middle of nowhere, all for the privilege of performing stand-up at some dive. She would go anywhere and do anything in order to perform. And she was indefatigable. So she found that in the end, you know, throughout the course of her life, that was really the thing that sustained her, not any of this superficial stuff, social or otherwise.
Well, Leslie Bennett, thank you for being on Through the Eyes of Women. And thank you for writing the book, Last Girl Before Freeway, The Life, Loves, Losses, and Liberation of Joan Rivers.
Well, I hope other people find Joan Rivers' story as inspiring as I did, because I really did. As contradictory and maddening as she can be, she's an amazing role model for other women.
You've been listening to Through the Eyes of Women. I've been your host, Brenda Starr, and I've been speaking with author Leslie Bennett about her latest book, Last Girl Before Freeway, The Life, Loves, Losses, and Liberation of Joan Rivers. For more information, you can visit Leslie, LESLIE-BENNETTS.com, Leslie-Bennett.com. Through the Eyes of Women is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University. Thanks to today's engineer and editor, Katie Whiteside, and to the entire Through the Eyes of Women team. To listen to the program again, visit our blog at khsuwomen.com, where you can also learn more about the show and post listener comments. Join us again next Monday at 1:30, right here on KHSU.